If you're enjoying this podcast, please consider leaving a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It really helps me out a lot. Cheers.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
How can you make your story cohesive? How can you make every word, every character, every scene feel like it absolutely needs to be in your narrative? How can you make your story use this cohesion to resonate with readers and to say something about the human condition that keeps readers thinking about your book long after they finish? Hi, I'm Jed Hearn, and this is the Novel Analyst Podcast, where every episode I analyze a story I love to help you become a better writer. Today's episode is titled A Confusion of Princes by Garth Nix, The Triumph of Humanity. So this episode is all going to be about how you can use theme to create cohesion and resonance within your book and thus create a great reading experience for people. But before we get into that, quick personal update first. So the last couple of weeks I have been outlining my next book, which has been super exciting. A big writing lesson that I have learned from doing this outline is that it's going to feel murky. It's going to feel unclear. And throughout a lot of this outlining process, I was just wallowing through mud and I couldn't see my story resolving itself into something that was cohesive and resonant. But the more I just sat down and spent time in front of the screen, in front of my notebook, or just walking and thinking about the book, the more the pieces started to align together. And what I'm learning more and more as I continue to write is that you might not have all the puzzle pieces arranged exactly how they should be arranged after the first hour, the 10th hour, the 100th hour that you've worked on something. But eventually you're going to reach a stage where you fill out all the edge pieces of that puzzle and, you know, you get the corners of the puzzle, and then you start working your way towards the middle. And eventually, piece by piece, the story starts to take shape. It starts to become clear. And I wish there was a shortcut for this, but the only way I have found to get through this kind of murky stage is to just keep at it, and the muse will eventually reward persistence. Or your story will just turn out to be a complete mess and it won't work anyway. But that hopefully won't happen to you. It didn't happen to me in this case. I found that after about a month or so of outlining, in the last couple of days that I had set, conveniently just before the deadline I'd set for it, the story just materialized into something that I knew exactly how it was going to start, middle and end. Having said that, I am yet to begin writing the first draft, so we will see how my brave fighting words go. So, today's episode is all about A Confusion of Princes, a space opera science fiction novel by Garth Nix. This is one of my favorite books. I have been wanting to do a podcast episode on this since I started the Novel Analyst show over a year ago. So, this has been a long time coming, and I'm referring back to notes that I took, like a solid, 8 months ago for this podcast episode. So, there will be spoilers ahead for A Confusion of Princes. So if you have not read the book, I would encourage you to go pick it up. I have read it multiple times. It is amazing. And then return to this episode. So A Confusion of Princes follows Khemri, who is a prince. And in the futuristic intergalactic setting that this book is set in, princes are these kind of telepathic rulers. There's thousands of them, and they're all competing in their own ways to become the emperor, the almost godlike figure who rules this empire that stretches across hundreds of thousands of stars and planets. So the book follows Khemri's journey from being a young prince who doesn't know that there's all these other princes out there battling for this right to become the next emperor, to Khemri who starts to come of age and he starts to survive in this world, and who eventually starts to realize that maybe the world isn't as perfect as he thought it was, and he sets about trying to change things and trying to live a normal human life, despite the fact that he is anything but a normal human. Like all the other princes, Khemri is blessed with a form of immortality where you are constantly connected via telepathic means to the Emperor's imperial mind. So if you die, your consciousness will get reanimated in another body. But that's only if you were proven worthy during your life. So there's tons of princes trying to do glorious deeds to make sure they can get resurrected, and it is a stunning space opera book. It's kind of crazy to think about how much stuff happens with it, considering that it is only, like, I think about 300 or so pages. It feels like an entire series worth of stuff is crammed into one book. But when I say it feels like that, it doesn't detract from the reading experience, because the book is remarkably cohesive, and this cohesion creates resonance, which is what I'm going to be analyzing in today's episode. So why are cohesion and resonance important things to have in your book? Well, cohesion is where everything in your story works together, complementing each other and forming a masterwork where each piece is vital, just like that puzzle analogy I gave earlier. In a cohesive story, each piece is vital to the story and each piece is wonderful. You can kind of think about a cohesive story as a story that treats various narrative elements like bricks. It combines all of these different things into a single structure where you couldn't take out just one piece without the whole thing falling down. Every single piece is critical to the execution of the whole. So that's what cohesion is. What about resonance? So resonance is this feeling you get, and you have probably experienced this feeling many times, where you feel like a story is appealing to you. It's appealing to some aspect of the universal human condition, to truths known to the reader, and it's evoking your emotions in a way that is meaning that the story doesn't just stay on the page, but it's actually coming off the page and it's coming into your own lives and your own minds and your own heart. And through doing so, it resonates with you, meaning that it stays with you long after you finish the final pages. So the more stories that I read, the more I realize that cohesion and resonance are really two things that I really, really, really want to experience in a story, whether it's a movie, whether it's a book, whether it's a play, because these are the things that make the story feel artistic and well-structured, in the sense of a cohesive story is also generally a well-written story, and resonance is the thing that allows the story to stay with me and to stay with you for long after you finish it. So, in my opinion, the best way to create cohesion is through theme. So theme is defined as, quote, "Whenever you present a character using a means to reach an end, you are presenting a moral predicament, exploring the question of right action, and making a moral argument about how best to live," end quote. John Truby from The Anatomy of Story. So that's kind of a good way to think about theme. Theme as moral argument. So theme isn't a one-word thing like subject matter. It's a question, if you like. I prefer to think about it as a question that is explored from multiple angles throughout your book. So the example I often use is, consider the theme of money is the root of all evil. Great. So we take that theme, we apply it to a story we're writing, and then we show different characters reacting to this theme in different ways. So you might have one character who is thinking, yes, I agree with the theme, money is the root of all evil, I'm going to sell all my possessions and go to Nepal and be a monk or something. Then you have another character who's like, I reject the theme, I don't think money is the root of all evil, I'm going to become really rich so I can use it to help people who are in poverty. Two different reactions to the same theme, and now, as John Truby says, you are exploring the question of right action, and through doing so, presenting a moral argument about how best to live to your readers. So it's not being preachy or anything like that, it's just asking a fascinating question and seeing interesting characters explore it in ways that generate conflict and make readers think deeply. So a strong thematic principle, a strong execution of the theme, is going to provide you with your framework for crafting these stories that feel cohesive. So in A Confusion of Princes by Garth Nix, the theme isn't necessarily power, even though the book is about all these different princes competing to gain power through becoming the emperor of this galactic civilization, that's not necessarily the theme. That's just the subject matter. The way that I read it, a Confusion of Princes theme is this. And you might have a different interpretation of it, in which case, you know, I would love to hear from you. And I think that's kind of the beauty of this thing, right? Is we can all read the same story and come away having read different stories. So the way I interpret A Confusion of Princes, the theme is this. No matter how much society tries to repress it, the human spirit is unconquerable. I'll say it again. No matter how much society tries to repress it, the human spirit is unconquerable. So before I get into arguing why I think this is A Confusion of Princes theme and why I think that this is the reason why the story feels cohesive and resonant, I just want to leave you with a particularly relevant idea from Story by Robert McKee, who says, quote, I prefer the phrase controlling idea instead of theme, for, like theme, it names a story's root or central idea, but it also implies function. The controlling idea shapes the writer's strategic choices. It's yet another creative discipline to guide your aesthetic choices towards what is appropriate or inappropriate in your story, toward what is excessive, what is expressive of your controlling idea, and may be kept, versus what is irrelevant to it and must be cut. End quote. So the controlling idea, which is Robert McKee's term for the theme, is shaping the writer's strategic choices. That means it's an excellent tool to achieve cohesiveness, because remember, cohesiveness is about having a singular vision. It's about making sure that everything in your story links together in a way that feels like every piece should be there. So how does Garth Nix achieve this in A Confusion of Princes, this idea of exploring this theme? Well, there are a ton of different ways that you can analyze theme, but I am going to be using this approach of analyzing the story web. So I define the story web as the means by which each story element is connected to each other through the exploration of theme. And again, the theme is that moral argument or question that your story is exploring. So your story web is literally taking every aspect of your story, character, plot, setting, dialogue, structure, any other story element you can think of, and then linking them and making them comment on each other, react to each other, conflict with each other with regards to the theme. So remember, the theme was that idea that no matter how much society tries to repress it, the human spirit is unconquerable. So let's analyze the story web within A Confusion of Princes to see if this is indeed the theme, and if so, how it is explored in a way that generates cohesion and resonance. So we start with the main character, Khemri. Like I mentioned before, Khemri is a prince, a telepathic royal who has immense power, but also is slightly unhuman, in the sense that death doesn't really affect him, and he has been implanted with all these mechanical and psychic implants to alter his personality to make him more competent of being this kind of ruling persona. But we see throughout the book, Khemri progresses. Khemri progresses from this kind of non-human, highly enhanced, almost cyborg-like person towards a more human version of himself. He progresses towards a deeper, greater connection with the world and with other characters. He goes from being someone at the start of the book who just views everyone around him as, you know, kind of secondary and dispensable, to someone who is willing to sacrifice his life for other people at the end of the book. And through this character, through Khemri's character arc, we see the story conveying this theme that no matter how strongly it is repressed, the human spirit is indomitable. The princes are designed and engineered to be as non-human as possible, so that they are crafted as the perfect ruling machines, if you like. But despite all of these disadvantages stacked against Khemri's capability to become human, he still does it. And that seems to argue from a thematic perspective that you can't repress humanity. Let's move on to another character. So Khemri is surrounded by several priests, and the priests do various functions within this world, such as being assassins, such as calculating probabilities, such as, you know, helping him with psychic stuff. But his main priest is an assassin called Master Haddad. And, oh, I didn't even realize that that guy's name has the word dad in it, and he is in fact a dad slash father figure in the book. There you go. So while Master Haddad is firmly embedded in the kind of imperial empire system, in the sense that he is a priest and his main loyalty is to the emperor, not Khemri, he has small signs of rebellion, such as when he goes against orders to help Khemri in certain situations and does these kind of, you know, subtle acts of subverting authority. He goes from just working from Khemri as a servant and really serving the emperor to actually becoming Khemri's friend at the end. And that suggests, again, this idea that no matter how strongly you try to repress it, whether that's through, in this case, institutions and industry and the way that society is organized, no matter how strongly you try to use those factors to repress it, the human spirit is still indomitable and it's still going to break out, much like a weed growing through cracks in the pavement, I suppose. We also see this theme reflected even more strongly in a different part of the character web, or the story web. And I'm talking specifically about these characters called the Mechby Troopers. So, if you're familiar with sci-fi, you're probably familiar with the idea of just these military grunts who are pretty faceless and generally the people who get mowed down by the aliens when they invade. That's basically who the Mechby Troopers are here. They are these almost robot-like grunt soldiers. And at the beginning of the book, Khemri just thinks that they're all basically the same. How you know, unique can they be? They're just all these, like, buff, cyborg-esque, highly enhanced humans who, like, don't talk and have big guns. Classic sci-fi tropes, right? But that's not the case. Because after spending time with them, Khemri discovers that they all have unique personalities. And when some of them die during this scene where a military base is attacked, Khemri actually feels sad for some of the dead troops because he's come to know them. So we see here a great reflection of this idea that no matter how strongly it is oppressed, the human spirit is indomitable. These people have been, you know, literally programmed and coded and engineered from the beginning of their existence to basically be bland, faceless goons, yet they still find a way to break this expectation and to reinforce this theme. Another character who echoes and develops the theme within the story and also affects Khemri's arc a lot is Rain, who is this woman who Khemri falls in love with, and she's just this ordinary human who teaches him the joys of you kind of normal, banal human existence within a world where Khemri is very unfamiliar with banal human existence, being, of course, a, you know, immortal prince with all these riches and all this power. So she kind of gradually sways Khemri away from his initial belief that the accumulation of power is the only real goal of life. And through doing so, she massively reflects the theme as well and helps Khemri internalize the theme, because she has sort of already accepted the theme from the beginning of the book. She doesn't really have that much of an arc. But the flat nature of her arc, the constant belief, the constant internalization and acceptance of the theme allows the character of Rain to make other characters consider the theme. And that's another way you can think about this. It doesn't just have to be every character having the exact same journey with the theme. You don't want that at all. What you really want is different characters to have different responses to the theme and this web of different interpretations to reflect back on the main character and to make them question the way that they are interacting with the world, and through that device affecting readers, reaching out to affect readers. So the last character I'm going to analyze before I will analyze a different part of the story web is the Emperor. So again, the Emperor is the ruler of this massive galactic empire. Every 20 years they abdicate and another emperor is chosen, which is what all the princes are competing for. And until then, they rule over the Imperial Mind, which is kind of this gestalt entity where there's thousands or, you know, hundreds of thousands of minds of the former emperors, all subsumed into this kind of like one conglomerate mass. And the emperor has to be replaced every 20 years because after this period, the emperor is no longer able to keep from being subsumed by this immense weight of telepathic mind and force that is inside the imperial mind. So when you look at it from that perspective, it would seem like the character of the emperor within the story web is actually arguing the opposite to the theme. Rather than this idea that the human spirit is unconquerable, you can kind of take a look at the emperor and say, well, it looks like the human spirit's getting pretty conquered right now by this massive psychic hive mind that is the imperial mind. And you'd be right. And that's exactly what the point of considering theme as a moral argument is. Any good argument has to acknowledge the other side. Otherwise, you're just preaching. And people don't want to read a story that's just preaching at them. They want to see something explored in a fascinating and compelling way from both sides. So, however, while I did say this would seem to reject the theme, it's actually subverted. It's subverted when Khemri's sister, Atalan, becomes the emperor in the book's climax. And despite these massive mental pressures of the imperial mind that I mentioned before, Atalan retains enough of her humanity to do something special. She retains enough of her humanity to grant Khemri protection to leave the empire and rejoin his lover. And thus, the theme of the indomitable power of humanity is reinforced. Because while Atalan, you know, will probably be subsumed by the imperial mind within 2 decades, as the other emperors have, she has demonstrated that this subjugation of the human spirit can never really be fully complete, and that there will always be room in there to act on individual free will and to do decisions that are motivated by humanity and not, you know, power or pressure from external forces, which is essentially what the imperial mind is. So what we can see through those different characters is that the story web is developed in such a way to provide different angles of attack on the theme. And it's not just characters who are part of the story web, like I mentioned before. You've also got things like plot, dialogue, structure, and the last element that I'm going to talk about, setting. So my absolute favorite moment in A Confusion of Princes comes right near the climactic final scenes. So at the end of the book, 1,000 princes who have been selected for their worthiness all are sent out into these little boats, and they are about to be sent off to endure trials from which one of those princes will become the next emperor. And only one of them will become the emperor, the other 999 will never be seen again. And right before this scene, right before this climactic showdown, we have this beautiful moment where Khemri looks up to the sky, this, you know, very futuristic sky, and he sees a moon. It's our moon, the old moon from Earth, which in this book is actually carried out on a modified artificial orbit past the home planet which this scene is taking place on. And it's just this beautiful moment that connects us to what is really happening in the story. Because it's emerging at this critical moment that's meant to remind readers of the power and the triumph latent within humanity. It's a reminder that you can never really leave what makes us human behind, no matter how many alterations, how many cyborg modifications, no matter how many implants are going to get put in you within the future. There'll always be this reminder of where you came from. And it's not just biology, it's arguably a spiritual thing, because the characters in this book are all biologically manipulated and implanted and programmed in such a way that you'd think they would completely have destroyed any remnant of humanity as we would recognize within them. But despite all this, despite this massive pressure to forget their humanity, the reemergence of the moon just reminds Khemri of who he really is, that he is really human, just like the rest of us. So it's one of the most breathtaking and cinematic moments of the novel, which, you know, really had me close to tears, which is why I wanted to bring it up here. And it just has this wonderful moment of transcendence, which I found in a couple of other books, and I try to write my own stuff as well. That sounds a bit like self-pumping up, but there's just something so beautiful about these intensely symbolic moments, but they can only become intensely symbolic and intensely resonant with readers because of the cohesiveness of your book. Because when this old Earth moon shows up in A Confusion of Princes, you know exactly what it means. You know that it means it's a symbol of the power of humanity, the power of love. And the only reason you know that is because every other part of the story web has been exploring this, has been making you realize that this is what the book is about. So to wrap up this episode, A Confusion of Princes is a masterful sci-fi book, not just because of the, you know, crazily awesome world building and all the different fun characters and the tight plot that is explored throughout the book, which are, you know, elements I would have loved to touch upon but didn't really get time to mention. But really it's great because of the cohesiveness and resonance that is expressed within it because of theme. So I would encourage you within your own stories to consider what you're really writing about. What is the heart of your story? What is the theme that you are exploring? When you know what that theme is, that's when you really have an opportunity to write something that isn't just the words on the page, but is feelings and ideas that will go into your readers and stay with them for a long time and hopefully make them live better lives. So to end this part of the episode, before we get to a question, I want to read to you my favorite poem, which is a fantastic reflection of the theme that the power within humanity is indomitable, that the human spirit cannot be conquered. And that poem is Invictus by William Ernest Henley. Out of the night that covers me, black as the pit from pole to pole, I thank whatever gods may be for my unconquerable soul. In the fell clutch of circumstance, I have not winced nor cried aloud. Under the bludgeonings of chance, my head is bloody, but unbowed. Beyond this place of wrath and tears looms but the horror of the shade, and yet the menace of the years finds and shall find me unafraid. It matters not how straight the gate, how charged with punishments the scroll, I am the master of my fate, I am the captain of my soul. And now it is time for a question from one lovely listener. So if you would like to ask me a question, whether that's about this episode, previous episodes, or writing in general, or anything else that's a related topic, you can go to jedhearn.com/question. The link to that will be in the show notes. Or you can just send me an email, jed.hearn1@gmail.com. That's jed.hearne1@gmail.com. And again, the link to that is in the show notes. And if you're lucky, I might even answer the question on the podcast, as I am about to do with this question. So Dale's question goes like this. Quote, I was writing the other day and it dawned on me that I don't have any experience writing combat. My idea has characters that fight using guns, typical melee weapons like bats or brass knuckles, but they also have enhanced senses and physical strength, as well as rudimentary elemental control, all in varying combinations. I'm wondering, are there any overarching principles that allow an author to write compelling combat scenes that highlight the extraordinary nature of these abilities, while grounding them in the real world, or at least the world I've developed? End quote. So thanks again for your question, Dale. For me, fight scenes are not really that interesting, per se. What I mean by that is that they're not really interesting in and of themselves. Because unlike a movie, where there can be cool choreography, awesome effects, and explosions, books don't really have that. Books don't do visuals. What books do, well, however, is emotion. So the key to writing a great fight scene in a book is all about the setup. Have you established why readers should want your protagonist to win? What's the stakes if they lose? Who's counting on them to win? Is it clear that the opponent's stronger than them? Does this fight symbolize something greater than merely a combat between protagonist and antagonist, good guy and bad guy? Can it reflect a wider conflict within society? Can it symbolize a moment of growth or regression for the characters? Can it say something complex about the human condition? If you can build up the fight to be meaningful, then the fight scene will be interesting. So all of your work is done in setting up the foundations for it. So you might be thinking right now that, okay, Jed, that's all well and good, but this means you've got to do a lot of work to earn each fight scene. That's the point. Action by itself doesn't necessarily make a good book. Action that progresses the plot or is a logical reaction to what has happened before, that's the kind of action that excites readers. So, in terms of the part of your question where you were asking, how the magic works and how you can use magic to make compelling fight scenes along with cool weapons, here's some ideas. So, first of all, I think it's really important that readers understand the limits of the powers. So, particularly if the main character is going to be using some weird type of magic or cool weapons to escape from trouble, they need to be clearly established to the readers what they can do. Your ability to kind of solve problems with magic is very directly linked to how clearly readers understand said magic. So I don't so much mind antagonists having unexplained powers and antagonists being the ones who just come up with random magic to get the character into trouble, to get the protagonist into trouble rather. But it's usually very unsatisfying for a protagonist to display, you know, previously undiscovered abilities to get out of trouble. And, you know, that's possibly the one minor gripe I have with aspects of the Harry Potter books. Sometimes it does feel like Harry just comes up with a new magic to save the day, even though it is revealed in the falling action that it kind of makes sense why it happens. That's my only minor gripe with those books, which I love. So the second point is to avoid bogging fight scenes down in tons and tons of description. So it's way more gripping to say that they grappled rather than, say, describing the exact positioning and movement of characters' fists. We don't really want a play-by-play. We want the essence of a fight scene. The third point is that, like with everything else in a story, you kind of want it to be clear. Make sure readers know the geography of a place before you as a writer start using that geography in a fight. The fourth point is that, unlike movies, books don't do well at having a single hero mow down a horde of faceless villains. Again, you don't have visuals, but you do have emotions. So focus on stuff that's emotional. For me, a scene of two estranged brothers slugging it out in a rainy street behind a pub to try and resolve their angry relationship, that's going to win for me every single time compared to a gun-toting hero blasting a mass of charging zombies. Yawn. Penultimate point here. This might just personally be something that I like. I got my tongue twisted there. But I really like fight scenes that come after me begging for them to have happened for 50, 100, 200 pages. Because I personally find that it's really satisfying to make readers, you know, want to see Bob punch Jack on page 50, but not let the fight between Bob and Jack begin until page 300, because there's just all this tension built up during that time. And of course, this doesn't give you an excuse to just draw things out for the sake of it, but it's kind of coming back to this idea of build-ups and payoffs. And I guess I like to think about it as a roller coaster. The higher you can convince people to climb up the roller coaster that is your story, the more exhilarating the descent will be. And then my last point with magic-based fight scenes is have fun. One of the joys of fantasy and sci-fi is creating interesting fights where there's strange magics, these crazy tools, you know, these awesome weapons being used in interesting and compelling ways. That's a big draw card for fantasy and sci-fi books. I went into big detail describing a really excellent fight scene in the 38th episode of the Novel Analyst podcast, which was all about Words of Radiance by Brandon Sanderson. giving readers chills. I will link to that in the show notes. If you want to hear me analyze a fight scene in more detail, go check that episode out. So with that, I hope that really helps. And again, I am always happy to answer your writing questions because it, you know, selfishly helps me clarify my thinking. It gives me ideas for podcasts and blog articles or whatever. So if you have a question, dear listener, keep sending them through. Send them to jedhearn.com@gmail.com or go to my website, jedhearn.com. Wait, I think I did the links right. The links are in the show notes anyway. You can check out the links in the show notes if you want to send in a question. So with that, time to wrap another episode of the Novel Analyst Podcast. Now go and write extraordinary stories. I'll see you next time.